Well, hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Project 223 podcast. Broadcasting from an undisclosed location behind enemy lines, carving out a stronghold of resistors to corruption, tyranny, and evil, teaching you to become more self-reliant for the coming troubles ahead. We've got a special guest with us today that I know you're going to enjoy. So, if you don't know the difference between an observation post and a fence post, stand by, because some truth bombs are incoming today on Project 223. All right, well, here we are with author and speaker Joe Dolio from Tactical Wisdom. Joe, glad to have you this morning.
Hey, I'm really glad to be here.
Awesome. Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of your books and your blog. I'm excited to have you on to share some of your tactical wisdom with our audience and to let them get a chance to kind of meet you over the air and get familiar with you. So glad you're here. If you don't mind.
That's a good, because if they just go by my Twitter timeline, it's a dumpster fire and it's probably get a bad impression of me. It probably would.
Yeah, Twitter's all over the place. So yeah, no, your books, and I definitely encourage people to get the books, and we'll talk about how to get, where to get those and all that in a little bit. So yes, the books are great, and also the YouTube channel. So if you don't mind, a little bit about your background, you were in the Marines, that's correct?
That's correct. I was a military policeman with the U.S. Marines. So I went through boot camp at MCRD San Diego, and for those who've been there, here's a little insider thing, and those of you who haven't, you'll learn something. One of the courses that you run every single day runs right alongside San Diego International Airport. So your drill instructor every single day is like, "See that plane, boy? I bet you wish you were on it." So it's just a little extra piece of boot camp you learn there. So anyway, I went to boot camp in San Diego. I tell you, the best part about being a military policeman in the Marines is that you trained at the time. You trained at Lackland Air Force Base. And if anyone's ever served in the military, you know the Air Force has the best food. It's like going to the old country buffet, but better. So that was kind of cool. But after that, I did some time both at Camp Pendleton and Camp Lejeune and a few other places around the world. But kind of cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, I know one of our mottos, you know, I was in the Navy, and we said the only good Marine was a submarine, because I was a submariner, but obviously I love the Marines. So, yeah.
That's okay. You have to be, you know, somewhat mentally damaged to be in the Navy anyway.
Yeah, I was just right down the street there at the sub base Point Loma. And yeah, we used to, speaking of looking at planes, we would sit there on the pier getting ready to go back down into this stinky submarine, and we'd watch the jets take off of North Island, and we'd sit there and curse our recruiter why we didn't do a job like that.
Man, I got all kinds of submarine jokes, but I'm going to spare them. But you do learn to hate recruiters no matter what branch you're in and no matter where you're stationed, because you're like, "But I was told I was gonna," and they're like, "You still believe your recruiter? You got problems."
Yeah, I went in, I think, to be a crypto tech or something of that nature, and then ended up talking to a recruiter who was a machinist made on nuclear submarines. Well, guess what my job ended up being?
Yeah.
Machinist made on a nuclear submarine.
Machinist made, yep.
So, yeah, so that was good. Well, and I did spend some good time with the submarines. I really enjoyed going to, I went to Navy scuba school down there on the amphib base in Coronado. And it was a 27 recon and force recon Marines, and me and a couple other sailors. And so we got to learn the Marine Corps song pretty well, because when we were sitting in the cold showers before pool week, we had to sing that from the halls of Montezuma every day. So,
yeah. Nice. Now, hold on, though. That is not merely a song. It is a hymn.
A hymn, yes. The Marine Corps hymn. Yes, sir. That's awesome. Yeah, so good deal. So I appreciate you serving in the Marines. And you know, now currently you work as a forensic investigator. Is that true?
Well, I'm a certified forensic interviewer and a certified fraud examiner. So basically, I've been a corporate security professional ever since I got out of the Marine Corps. I began as a protection specialist for the Stroh family. And those in Michigan know the Stroh family was a big thing at the time. They owned Stroh's Brewery.
Yeah.
And from there, I went into protection work for the Amway families. And there's a lot of executive protection work to be had in Metro Detroit, but I kind of drifted towards corporate investigations where you're looking at high-level internal theft or business-to-business fraud. And I actually wound up doing a lot of credit card fraud on a task force here with the FBI and Secret Service. So pretty good stuff.
Wow. So that's quite a bit of experience. So you've actually have real world experience in helping protect people that may be a little unaware of personal protection, situational awareness, and things like that.
Absolutely. I still have several protected clients. Now I'm pretty much a consultant on my own. I've got several protection clients who are big names that people know, but they're aware of the threat. But for a while there's a lot of corporate people who don't know the level of hatred that was out there even 10, 15 years ago from the left towards corporate board members and CEOs. So there's a lot of angst out there. It's a lot of fun. And when the global war on terror began, there became a lot of opportunity in the executive protection field because that brought terrorism home, right? And then there was opportunities to serve in war zones doing executive protection and with private military companies and kind of a business that took off, and I've kind of benefited from it, and I've got a lot of real world experience in it.
Well, that's great, and I can see how all that experience and that knowledge from the Marine Corps to doing that job, that you've been able to take that and put it into writing and put it into books so that average Americans, average citizens can take that and learn from that and apply that to their own life now and to the coming troubled times that are in front of us, I think. So, yeah, that's great. I appreciate you doing that.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And so a big part of why I enjoy you and your work that you do is your personal faith. You're a Christian man, is that correct?
Absolutely. So I've actually always been a Christian, but I'm Italian, so therefore by law I was required to be Catholic. which, as I look back over the 20 plus years that I was a Catholic, I learned that that's not really that much of it was true Christianity. So I have this firm belief that things can be from man or from God. And to me, in all honesty, so much of the Catholic faith was from man and not from God. And so I kind of went and found a new church. We tried out a new place and we loved it. Haven't ever looked back. It's a non-affiliated Christian church. And it's just about the Bible and what Jesus said and not some man's interpretation of it and what rules they think you should have.
Sure.
So it's pretty good stuff. And that's actually where the whole tactical wisdom idea came from. So there's a Bible study program out there called Every Man a Warrior. And a few years ago, I was making all the mistakes that men can make, right? Messing up relationships with family, messing up my business, messing up literally everything that could go wrong. And I was advised to try this Every Man a Warrior program. It's put on by the Navigators. It's a great thing. And so I took it the first time, and the guy didn't really make us do the work, so I liked the content, but I didn't get much from it. So I went to the guy who runs it here locally, and he's like, no, listen, man, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to have you be in charge of a table, and I'm going to give you a different instructor and all this kind of stuff. And man, it's a great thing. It teaches men how to be the leader of their family, the protector of their family, and the warrior that fights for that family's faith and freedom, right? So I loved the program. I now teach it all over the place. I'm an ambassador for Every Man a Warrior. But when I was teaching my first group, I was finding stories in the Bible about survival, preparedness, action, resistance to tyranny, and things like that, and sharing it with my group. And they're like, where are you finding these stories? I'm like, trust me, they're in the Bible. And listen, for those of you listening, if you want cool action and adventure stories that rival the Lord of the Rings, go with Joshua. Go with Nehemiah. You can't go wrong. But anyway, there are these great stories in there about men standing up for their rights and men standing up for their families and just being warriors, right? So people are like, man, that's really cool stuff, man. You should write this down. I'm like, well, it's already written down. It's already in the Bible. So I started a blog about it, right, where I would take these stories from the Bible and explain how they apply to today. So for example, like David. David was a veteran, and after he served in a war, the king decided that those veterans that David leads, they're kind of dangerous to our country. We should shun them. Boy, does that sound familiar, right?
Possible extremist.
he might be somewhat of an extremist, you might say. And so I just took those stories and applied them to life, and people really liked it. And you know, Mrs. JD has frequently said, you should write a book. Now, I think half the time she was being kind of a smarty pants, but so I did. I took the idea and I wrote the first book, and it was just about, I found that in a lot of preparedness literature, everyone wants to talk about all the cool guy gear and what kind of water filter you need and what kind of, what's the best kind of tent and tarp and all this kind of stuff. And it's always got to be the newest and most expensive. And I just said, no, here are the bare minimum things you need, right? And that's where I went with, and people loved it. And I originally thought if I could get, you know, 100 of my friends or so to buy it, that's cool. I've checked that box, right? I wrote a book. But it just has really taken off. And now we're at book four, and it's just every month sales are better than the month before. So it's important knowledge that we need to get out there. And the most important piece of it is that every single chapter I write, I begin it with the Bible verse that supports it, right? And lots of people don't know that the Bible supports preparedness. It does. It's in there.
Exactly. Well, we're even jumping ahead. I want to hit on a lot of those things you've talked about. We've got a pretty similar past. I was raised Catholic, went to Catholic school first to eighth grade, and had dealt with the nuns and everything. And yes, similar to you, there wasn't, I didn't have that spiritual connection there, and went on later to become a Christian on my own through a ministry called Young Life. And I currently, same thing, go to a non-denominational church. But I look back now, I have some great friends that are godly, you know, God-fearing Catholics. And so, you know, I think I didn't make that connection myself, but I know there are some good Catholics out there. So I appreciate those that truly have a relationship with Jesus. So That's pretty cool. No, that I'm excited that Every Man a Warrior Bible study. I've heard you talk about it before, and I definitely should check that out. That sounds like a pretty cool.
Absolutely, it's really a great, fantastic program. Three books. You can do it a book at a time. It's 8 or 10 lessons a book, and it's just great stuff. It covers every area of life.
Yeah, and the Navigators is a great organization. They've been around for a long time, so I've got other books from them. So, and so currently. Is there a hero of the faith in your life right now, whether that be well-known author or pastor or teacher or somebody that's just a local person for you that means a lot to you or that you would share?
Yeah, I got this guy. His name is Bill McGlone. And Bill runs Every Man a Warrior here, kind of in the southeast Michigan area. And the thing is, he doesn't look at it as just a program, right? For him, it is literally a way of life. He takes every guy in that's in his group, and they become like a stepson to him.
Wow.
And he invites their families over. He really lives that model of servant leadership, right? So you go to his house for a meeting, and him and Kathy have a spread set out for you. They make sure you're comfortable. They take good care of you, and they draw your whole family in. And you know what? That's something that we've gotten away from is we talk about our own faith journeys, and we go to church, but we don't associate with Christians other than on Sunday. And we need to get back to that. And so Bill and Kathy really envision that. And he is what has kept me involved with Every Man a Warrior. And he's dragged me along, kicking and screaming at times, but he has brought me along. And man, the dude is literally a hero. He's saving lives every day. He doesn't even know it.
Wow. Sounds like him and his wife have got the gift of hospitality, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Great people.
You know, people like that, I don't think they realize how much they affect others. I remember people from when I was in the Navy down in Florida, away from home as an 18-year-old, and having a family from the local church that brought me in. And I'll never forget those people and how they helped me and made me feel. So we can really affect other people in our lives just by loving them and just loving them through God's love. So that's pretty cool.
Right on.
All right. Salute to Bill. Hero of the faith. Well, great. So the tactical wisdom philosophy that your books are based on, and we started getting into it already, it's Bible-based wisdom. And I like the way what you call the Bible is the ultimate tactical handbook. Is that correct?
Oh, it absolutely is. That's what I call it. And if you get in and look at it, it really is. There's not a problem in life you can't find an answer to.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. One thing, though, I want to ask you about is tell me what you think about some of these Christians that you run into. I'm sure I've run into them a lot, but basically kind of have this pacifist attitude where, you know, hey, you know, why are you storing food, or why are you worried about, you know, self-protection? Just have faith. You know, God's going to provide. What do you think when you talk to people like that, and how do you address that?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, this whole pacifist thing is ridiculous. I don't know where they get that, because if you look at the Old Testament, it says God is a man of war. And when you look at the New Testament, Jesus himself said, "Do not think that I came to bring peace. I came to bring a sword to the world." A man of peace.
He wasn't a hippie, long-haired hippie going around just preaching to love everybody and give away all your food?
My man, in a modern context, was 3D printing his own weapons. He made a homemade whip to drive people out.
At the temple.
That is not a man of peace.
He did.
So there's another author out there who writes this fantastic book that addresses that Just Have Faith issue. His name is Aidan Tate. And the book is called The Faithful Prepper, A Christian's Guide to Understanding Prepping. And he says that people will tell you, just like you mentioned, that if you're trying to be prepared, you don't have faith in God. But that's a misconception of Scripture. That comes from people who listen to their pastor on Sunday, and that's the extent of their actual research in the Word, right? So when in my books, I point out that in Jeremiah, I believe it's 10:17, God tells you to have a bug-out bag. And Jeremiah said, "Gather up your belongings to leave the land, you who live under siege." That's God telling you to have a bug-out bag, right? And and throughout there, they talk about storing up food and having things available. The one verse that comes to mind to me is right from the Every Man a Warrior program, and it's Ecclesiastes 11:2. "Give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land." That's telling you to spread your supplies around, because you don't know what's going
to
happen.
Sounds like a cache.
Now, we use it now to talk about, I'm sorry?
Sounds like a cache to me.
Right. And yeah, exactly. It's about cashing your supplies, but it's also about diversifying investments and diversifying your plan.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the Bible, every single time the God will provide fallacy is there, but God always never done all of the work. He always wants you to do something. Like even when he gave some victories to Joshua, he said, "Listen, I'm going to need you to get the troops around. I'm going to need you to surround the city. I'm going to need you to march around it, and I'll do the rest." But you still had to do the work. And my favorite story I just put in book four is from Gideon. It's in Judges 6.
Yeah.
And in it, God says, "Hey, listen, you're going to go and you're going to beat these bad guys." And he does what we all do. "Yeah, God, but if you were truly God, how could you have let this happen? Why did you let the bad guys take us over? And why are you letting them oppress us? This is us now in America, right? Mm-hmm. Man, why is God letting this happen to us?" And God turned to to Gideon, and he said, "Am I not sending you?" So that's kind of a big conviction to all of us.
Look
God's
in the
like,
mirror.
I didn't let it happen, yeah. Right? I didn't let it happen. You were here the whole time. You could have done something, and you didn't.
Mm.
And I think that's why God will help us, but we have to do something, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I love that about God, is that he created us, but he put us into action. We have to build relationships. It's not exactly. And he gave us the free will as well to make those decisions. So, yeah.
I talk about this a lot in our own current moment, where we have these drag queen shows where they're taking our children there. Here's the problem I have with that, is that James 4:17 says, "If a man knows the good he ought to do and does not do it, that will count as sin for him." Yeah. Men, you know the good you ought to be doing, and you're not doing it. Anyway.
Yep. No, I was watching a video this morning of a man being dragged out of I believe it was a city council meeting or something by the cops for a shirt he was wearing and a sticker on his phone that was offending people. And he was being dragged out, and I turned to my wife and I said, these people around, they were hollering, but I said, they need to stand up and stop that stuff. And she said, "Well, you know, you need to obey the law." And I said, "There comes a point in time where I'm sure in Nazi Germany, they talk about the fact that if they would have stood up and fought back at certain times, would things have changed and been different, you know?" So,
yeah. I mean, seriously, he would have been a footnote to history if they had. And I don't want to turn people off by continuing to spout scripture, but one of my favorites is,
spout it.
Right. One of my favorites is Galatians 5:1. And I take this as a life philosophy. "It is for freedom's sake that Christ has set you free. Therefore, stand firm and never again allow yourselves to be burdened by the yoke of slavery." Brothers, I'm feeling a little bit burdened right now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, and that's on the Project 223 podcast. We're all about that. You know, our title, 223, and I loved it in your first book when I opened the first page, and you had it written down there. The wise man sees trouble and prepares, but the fool keeps going and suffers. And we're all about not only being prepared to live and thrive in this world, in this life, but most of all to be prepared for eternity. If we have all the beans, bullets, and Band-Aids in the world, and we make our stand against the roving hordes, but yet we stand before God and we do not have salvation and do not have eternal life, then it's all meaningless in my book. So we love it.
And I tell you, that verse right there just completely destroys that whole "just have faith and God will provide fallacy."
Exactly.
It's pretty too dangerous. Yep. Yeah. Do something about it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and then moving on is talking about faith versus action and stuff. A lot of what we do. So I do some firearms training and stuff. What do you say to some of the people of faith that say guns are bad, or, just let the police deal with the criminals?
Well, you've got to be alive for the police to deal with the criminals. And let's just be honest here. The police are there to keep you from doing things the government doesn't like. They're not there to protect you. That's been ruled time and again in the courts. And if you look going all the way back throughout history, that's the way it's always been. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked me this when I first started doing this, and I said, how can you as a Christian teach people to defend themselves, including with firearms? I said, what is your perception here? Well, it says thou shalt not kill. No, the Bible does not say thou shalt not kill. That is a very common misconception that we need to do a better job of fighting. What does it actually say?
You shall not murder.
You shall not murder. Right. Murder and killing are not the same thing. And people say, well, that's what God meant. And I go, okay, so if you believe the Bible, you believe that the Ten Commandments are real. Yes, I do. Okay, so then why in the very next book of the Bible does he tell Joshua to go and not only kill people, but to kill anyone who opposes him, cut their heads off, and put them on spikes outside of the town? Oh, well, that was the Old Testament. Okay, still God's word, right? You were going with another piece of the Old Testament to tell me it's wrong. It's not. So war and
there you go. Yeah, they use that. They pick and choose. They pick and choose the verses they want that backs up their point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jesus, when he was sending out his disciples and the 72 and everything, he always told them to be armed. He told them to take a staff and a rod with them when they went. Or if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one, because the road was a dangerous place. He didn't say, hey, if you get attacked, find a legionnaire and have him help you, right? No, he said, defend yourself. And there's even Bible verses that say, a strong man fully armed can defend his home. There's nothing wrong with defending your home. And we should be our own first responders, because in the times that are coming, but let's just look at this. Let me back up. Let me use Hurricane Katrina as an example.
Yes.
The police were there, but they were dealing with much bigger issues than your home burglary, right? They were trying to keep people from raping and killing each other in the shelters, and they were trying to keep the streets back from the bad guys who were trying to take over bridges to extort people. You got to learn that when bad things happen in a large geographic area, whether it's the whole country or whether it's just your area, you're not very high on the priority list. The mm-hmm. police are there to serve the government functions in that time. Mm-hmm. They're going to, just like we've seen in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Minneapolis, they're going to fall back and protect government buildings. They're not going to be helping you. So you absolutely need to be able to deal with things yourself.
Well, and what did they do to the law-abiding citizens that had guns during Katrina?
Yeah, seized them.
They came in
unlawfully, I might add.
They came in and unlawfully took them away. There's some good videos out on people talking about those situations. Yeah.
And you know what else I point out is that that was violating the Second Amendment. They also violated the Third Amendment. There's a video out there from some National Guard troops who they went to a church and wanted to stay there for the night. First of all, troops should never be staying in a church overnight. We'll start there. Second of all, when they couldn't find anyone from the church to ask permission, they forced their way in and camped in the church that night. That actually violates the Third Amendment.
Yeah.
Stationing troops in your own home. Uh-huh. That's God's house.
It goes back to the Revolutionary War, doesn't it?
Yeah. It takes us all the way back there. So it's interesting. They set aside what they want to.
No. Well, and I often talk when I talk to people about that, as far as just let the police handle it. I say, okay, so in being a first responder, I have a little bit of experience with stuff like this, but so somebody would be, they're being threatened but with violence of some kind. So they call a police officer. Well, what does that police officer bring to the scene? He brings a gun. And what's he going to do if that person doesn't, you know, comply? He's going to shoot and kill that person. So we're willing to put that off onto another man to have to maybe possibly take a life, but we're not willing ourselves to stand up to that violence, that evil, and be in that situation where we may have to take a life, which would be horrible. And obviously the rules of deadly force would have to be authorized. But I often think about that people, they're more than happy to let somebody else come in and have to deal with the trauma and the trials of that situation, but they're not willing to face it themselves.
Well, what I find ironic about the whole thing and the whole debate is that the people who are most against normal civilians carrying guns are also anti-police, but they also then say, but the police will protect you. It's just intellectual dishonesty times 10.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
A lot of the leftist logic doesn't make sense when you really look at it. So,
Oh, yeah.
Well, great. So, yeah, some of the current gun control issues that we see are rather scary statements by Joe Biden. What are some of your thoughts on what's going on in the future of firearms in the country?
I think that it's going to be under attack 100%. I think that his speech last week was designed to try and provoke action from someone. Mm-hmm. And said action they will then use as justification to set aside our legal system yet again and do something by executive decree on guns. Mm-hmm. Yep, that'll cause violence, but at this point they just don't care.
Yeah.
And I think that the Second Amendment is right there next to religious freedom. If you lose the Second Amendment, you lose religious freedom. And you might say, oh, that's hyperbole. Guess what? The Jews had their firearms rights taken away from them in Germany, and then they lost their religious freedom, mm-hmm. like days later. So the two are inextricably tied.
Yep, going back throughout history, the registration, the confiscation of firearms, and then
ask the Native Americans about gun control.
Oh yes, exactly. No, it's rather scary, and the sad thing is that, you know, for people like us. You know, and I still think there's a lot of conservatives, a lot of God-fearing, liberty-loving, patriotic Americans that think that, oh no, the government, they really care about us and they're on our side. But I really think that when you look at it, there is a group of ruling elites, and they can be on either side, but they want to take away our rights. They want to have a class that's ruling and a class that's ruled, and they can't do that with the current armed middle class in America. I think that's one of the beauties of this country is that we are able to stand up
Absolutely.
Against tyranny.
And you know, they give it away by their speech. Not once ever have they said, we don't need guns. They say, you don't need
guns. That's right. As their bodyguards so, with the automatic, you know, rifles under their coats are guarding
right
them
on,
their,
right on.
In their neighborhoods. No, that's, yeah, no, it's, I think we need to stand strong, and I think that's one of the red lines in the sand for me is the Second Amendment. So speaking of firearms, Joe, what's your everyday carry firearm?
Oh,
if you don't mind me asking.
I'm a man of peace. I am a man of peace.
Oh, good, good.
But let's say when I do protective details, it's a Glock 23C, 40 caliber. But I only chose it in 40 because that's what everyone else was carrying on the team. So it was to have commonality. I'm not one of these guys who believes in having the 9 versus 40 argument, because if I shoot you with a bullet, it doesn't matter what size it is, it's going to change your behavior. And 9 would allow me to carry a little bit more, but it is a Glock 23C and 40 caliber.
Sure, sure. If you had unlimited funds, what would be your any favorite pistol that you would like to get and have in your collection?
Oh man, you know, I don't know, but I think that the new SIG, the one that we're using for the military, the M18, that would probably be it, because they're grossly overpriced already, and it's only going to make it worse. But I think they're pretty good guns. I know that we use the SIG 229s for and 226s for our investigation teams in the Marines.
Sure.
And they really like it. Good guns. It's really the same platform.
So. Yep. Yeah, no, I like those old school SIGs. A Navy SEAL friend of mine pulls out his P226, and he does some pretty good work with that. I have one of those as well. But yeah, when the SIG went to the Striker fired, those are some pretty nice firearms as well. How about thoughts on red dot optics on pistols? Are you a yes or no?
I am a big no. I'm not a yes on anything technologically related. As I mentioned in my book, you need to go low to no tech, because what can fail will. And I don't need one more thing to snag on my clothing when trying to draw from concealment.
All right, good. Well, we heard it from Joe. He likes it old school. Well, yeah, and we had this current shooting in Tennessee just in the news here. And what do you think? Is this a one-off incident, or are things like this going to increase? This is a guy that went live streaming his rampage.
Yeah, I've been talking about this for weeks. You're already in a collapse. You just don't know it. You're just not acting like it. So he went on his rampage. I've been screaming the horn or blowing the horn about Black Hebrew Israelites. Every single month in America, they kill people. Going back to the attack in Jersey City on the Jewish deli and going forward, things like the Waukesha van attack was a Black Hebrew Israelite. The Dallas police shooting, Black Hebrew Israelite. The Baton Rouge police shooting, Black Hebrew Israelite. So these guys are actually out there doing things. Now, we don't know that this young man subscribed to that same philosophy who did the Memphis attack, but the two guys who made the threat the next day are spouting the same content that you hear from Black Hebrew Israelites. And we're seeing more of what's called Moorish American militias coming up. And then to respond to that, you're seeing some of these crazy white Christian ones like the Christian Identity on the other side of the country. And then you're seeing things like various Hispanic gangs that use the old term La Raza, which means the race. We're seeing, because of the rhetoric in this country, they're boxing us off into these different groups.
Yep.
And you're just seeing that some of the groups are more willing to use violence than others, and they're getting out there and they're doing it. So the problem is, we as a country have fallen hook, line, and sinker for this "we must be put into boxes" philosophy, and it's leading to this violence. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we're already in the beginning stage. We're sort of in an insurgency. Portland's been an insurgency for 2 years, and we're going to see more of these one-off attacks that aren't really one-off. They are part of a more organized campaign. The NFAC was a thing. and so were a few of the other weird militias that popped up. The Socialist Rifle Association. That's literally everyone on the left getting together, and they're training every weekend on firearms somewhere in this country. And they're training every weekend on trauma first aid. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that. They're calling for a socialist overthrow of the United States, and you can't do that without violence in the streets. Yeah. So I think we're just gonna see more of it.
Yeah, our friend NC Scout, he talks about that quite a bit on his channel on Brush Beater, on American Partisan. But I think they use a technique, Joe, I really do, of the divide and conquer. You know, if they can get us all fighting amongst ourselves, the average Americans, and focusing on race and fostering that racial hatred, I think the more they focus on it, the more it divides and the more problems it causes. And then they can get us fighting amongst ourselves, and we're not looking at them and watching them, laundering money by the billions to Ukraine and doing all this stuff around the world. So, I think the more and more we need to work on trying to not let them do that to us.
Well, and I think a bigger piece of it is that in our country, we are now legally justifying racism and discrimination, but in the opposite direction. We've got loan programs from Bank of America that specifically exclude Caucasians. We have non-white dormitories at colleges, which then implies that there are some that are white only. And you don't solve racism by responding with even more racism. That's literally never worked in the history of mankind.
Doesn't make sense.
So we have to learn to solve it by turning to each other, not at each other. And I don't see anyone really advocating that out there anywhere.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. I'm with you on that. We need to work on focusing on what we have in common and getting the God-fearing people. And I know Brooke talks about that a little bit on her podcast about getting the God-fearing people of every race and culture and community in America to focus on freedom and liberty, and to look at what are they trying to do to us, and what are the lies that we're being told that cause us to separate.
There's a great meme out there, and it shows a king standing up on his castle with an aide next to him. And it's got all these people on one side with torches and all these people on the other side with pitchforks. And the aide says to him, "You don't have to fight them all. You just have to convince the fork people that the torch people want to take their pitchforks away." And you know what? That's literally where we are, right?
Yes, sir.
And it's just crazy.
No, I'm with you quite a bit. So then going along as far as faith and preparedness and things like that, what about charity? And when we talk about a lot of your books are referring to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if we turn to a without rule of law situation, like you said, we were in a collapse, a slow collapse, but as things start to get worse and worse, we're going to find ourselves in times where we call 911 and nobody shows up, where there's the looting increases and the murders and crimes increase, and there's not a police officer to come. And, you know, I myself was a victim of being taken out of being a first responder because of not taking a experimental medical vaccine. And so you can see more and more that police officers, they defund the police, the way they're treated, they don't want to do that job anymore, and first responders are leaving. So down the road, calling 911 may just give us a busy signal. But so in that without rule of law situation, the collapse situation, what about charity? What role do we have as believers, and even just good, honest, God-fearing American citizens giving to other people? Should we give away our supplies?
So this is a big question, and it leads to a lot of heated arguments. And people tell me I'm wrong for my philosophy, but I say my philosophy literally comes from the Bible. And in 2 Thessalonians, Paul tells us that while we do want to be charitable and help others, he who does not work does not eat.
Mm-hmm.
So we can use that as our basis. And here's the thing. If you're living in any area, I tell everyone, first of all, if you're the only person not losing weight in your neighborhood, someone is going to come and ask you why, right? They're going to know you have food.
It's going to be a big target on you.
Right. And so if you're trying to be that charitable altar Christian who gives everybody the shirt off your back, if they're coming up and you're handing out food, word will get around that you have excess food. Nothing good will come of that, right? So I say, someone shows up and says, "Hey, man, look, we're really hungry. I need some food. Okay, I don't have a lot to spare, but I am in need of a hole dug over there for a new latrine. And you guys dig me that hole, I can give you a couple cans of food to get you through. And, or, hey, I need some firewood. You gather me up some firewood, I'll be willing to trade you a fair amount of food for that."
I like that.
Now, two things are going to happen. Number one, people are not going to think you have excess food if you're saying, "Hey, look, I only got a little bit. I can only give out, you know, in exchange for work." Number two, the more lazy people are going to not want to do it. They're just going to go somewhere else, right? But three, you're also going to be building somewhat of a Christian community. As the people come, you share with them a little bit of food, you share with them a little bit of gospel, and guess what? They're going to come back to do more work for you, and you're going to give them more food, and you're going to have a chance to speak to them. And you might be building your own local group that way. But we should not just give out charity when one, we can't afford it. Right. We cannot give out our food to where we die. And I get it. There's the story in the Bible of the lady who gave her last two pennies at church. That was money. That wasn't literal food and you will die if you give it out. So,
well, and there's a difference too between normal times and a without rule of law situation. Correct.
Correct. Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, I help out the guys on the corner when I think they're reliable, not the blind guy who magically, has his sight restored when it's break time or at the end of the day. But we try to help as much as we can now. But I always help by volunteering time more than just handing out freebies. Because if you hand out freebies, you get freeloaders. It's the whole give a man a fish thing, right?
Right.
Don't feed the bears, right? If I tell people, yeah, we're going to help you, but there's work involved, that goes ties back to the entire Bible's point of God will help you, but you've got to do something to improve your situation. So exactly. I don't just give anything out. There's got to be some work involved.
No, I love that. I've heard you talk about that on a podcast before, and I love that philosophy. No, it's in my previous career as first responder, as fire captain, we would go into these homeless camps because they would almost always catch on fire eventually from either their little campfire or them just burning it. And you would see piles and piles of sleeping bags and coats and blankets and things. And those were the things that, you know, some soccer mom and her little kid thought it would be good to come down and give to the homeless shelter. And guess what? They don't launder those and reuse them. They get used a few times and then they get left in the woods in a big pile of trash and catch on fire. So I see that and I realize that, you know, it's tough and it hardens you a little bit, but it's sadly it's drugs and alcohol and just the crime that caused people to get in that lifestyle to begin with, whether it's currently now in the homeless situation or just, you know, I think we're going to find in Without Rule of Law, it's people that weren't prepared. So you see often in books like the Jack Lawson's Civil Defense Manual or Patriots or the Going Home series, that people talk about what could happen if you do give away food willy-nilly, right? That person says, this person's got food, and they go back and tell their friends, and the next thing you know, you're getting raided by the you know, the biker gang or whatever that's out there killing and looting. So
yeah, I think they're going to come and ask the first time, they're going to come and tell the second time.
And if it's hey, we'll let you do a little work, and then they'll realize, oh, hey, there's no easy handout here. So
this also builds to one of my philosophies that I talk about in my books, is that even if your plan is to bug in, which is not realistic if you live in a city, but I digress. Even if your plan is to bug in, you have to have at least a temporary bug out plan. And you got to have at least some of your supplies still be portable.
Yes.
It's that important.
Yes, I like that. Well, as we go down here a little bit, I'm going to get into a couple of your books and we'll hit on a few of those things. But yeah, no, along with the charity, I feel bad because in my preparedness, you know, my son would say to me, Dad, you know, I'm worried that you're just going to open the door and blast hungry people on the porch.
Well, you know, as hard as it is for a kid to understand, at some point, it absolutely might be that necessary, because I would tell my son this: if the choice is the hungry people on the porch or you, I'm going to blast the hungry people on the porch every single time.
Exactly. And it's not necessarily the dad and the mom with the little kid that are innocent, but it's the three trucks of with guys in the back with rifles that are coming to rape mom and sister, shoot the dog and kill you and me. So that's yep. More of what I'm preparing for.
And here's the thing. I'm not going to shoot anyone who just knocks on my door looking for food.
Of course not.
But after we close the door, if you kick it and try to come through it, well, that's going to be a different story, isn't it?
Yep. Well, and if we follow your books, they're not going to be able to get to that front door without being observed, yeah, observed and stopped first. Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, great. So some of the books that you've got, if you don't mind, I'd like to just kind of hit on a few little highlights that I've seen in those books. Book one's the Baseline Training Manual. And I've got my signed copies of all of them sitting here. They're available on Amazon for anybody that wants to buy them, but I like buying them direct from Joe, so I don't have to feed the beast any more than possible. I think you maybe pay a few bucks more and wait a little bit longer, but you get the autograph, and that money's going directly to you, right?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
I like it. So it starts off with my favorite verse, like I mentioned earlier, Proverbs 2:23, and I read that, and I knew I was going to like the book. We came up with ours actually at our church. We were I was talking to my pastor, and this is a few years back, and I said, hey, what are we going to do if the food, you know, as we were seeing the riots in the cities and there was talk about, you know, food shortages. I said, what are we going to do if people start showing up at the church and they don't have food? And he's like, I don't know, that's a good question. He goes, well, we got the granola bars and the cup of noodles that we give the homeless when they knock on the door. And I said, yeah, I don't think that's going to cut it. So
it's not going to last long.
Not going to last long. But he actually pulled up that verse and told me a week later, and we came up with it. And we actually teach classes at our church. And we've got people in our church have really progressed in the last couple of years. People have emergency reserve power and reserve food supplies and a lot of stuff. So that's kind of how the Project 223 all kind of grew out of that. So
I think the food thing is going to become critical this fall and winter. So
exactly. No, that's huge. Yeah. So, and then just going along book one here, a couple things. I think we'll hit on food a little bit more as we go. Tactical gear and training, it talks about in book one. Why is that important? Do you think that normal Americans have any idea what could actually happen in a without rule of law situation?
So I've been to a few places in the world where a without rule of law situation was ongoing, and the average American or British person or Canadian has literally no concept of what that life is like. So I encourage people to get out and read a little bit. So there's a guy, Selko, who wrote some books about life in the former Yugoslavia.
Yep.
One of the great things you could do right now is just take a look at how life is along what's called the line of contact in Ukraine. People in a town like Avdiivka have been living in a without rule of law situation since 2014 when government was overthrown, and the city changes hands every other day. So you don't know who's manning the roadblocks today. Is it the federal government? Is it the rebels? Is it the Russians? Is it Chechens? They don't know. So the best thing they can do is learn how to avoid those checkpoints. And they learn not to live in buildings, because when the soldiers from whatever different group come through that week looking for food, if you're in a house, they're going to take your food. And people just haven't made that connection that it really can happen here. We've been fortunate in America to be protected by two oceans, right? And then two countries that one is so peaceful that they couldn't possibly invade another country, and the other one has so many problems of its own that they can't think about invading another country. So it's just a concept they can't grasp,
yeah.
But it's coming on very, very quickly, and we need to. So you need to get out and train on these skills. The biggest thing I talk about in book one is doing literally anything is better than what you're doing today, because today you're not doing anything. Getting up and walking a mile. A lot of people talk about, well, I could do it if I had to, but could you really? And could you do it carrying stuff on your back?
Exactly.
Right? So I say that's the first skill you need to learn is walking. You're not going to be driving a car. You're not going to be running around like Mad Max in his armored truck. You're going to be walking around on foot, and you got to learn it. I just don't think people think that far in advance. I don't think it really could happen.
Well, no, because it's normal to just get in your car and drive to the store to get three ingredients that you need for your dinner or...
Yeah, and here I talk about that a lot. Here in Metro Detroit, the average house has less than 48 hours worth of food in it, because there's literally a convenience store on the corner or a McDonald's or something. So if I really need food, I can just go there. But what about when you can't? And I think another thing is news suppression. So when Hurricane Katrina happened, yeah, they talked a little bit about what was going on. But having been involved with military contracting at the time, there was a lot more that went on that no one talked about. There were literal pitched battles with gang groups trying to control streets and bridges to extort people crossing them. There were people raiding others for food. There was a lot of self-defense going on. But these things didn't make it into the news because they didn't want anyone to see that. And you just got to understand it can happen here and it will happen here.
Sure. And so that leads to two different topics. But basically, along those lines, what do you think is the best way to keep up to date? I know that you've taken NC Scouts RTO class, as have I. Do you think two-way radios are important, or being a ham, and for the future that problems we're going to have?
You know what radios are, and not necessarily being a ham. But
sure.
What's funny about a lot of people in the ham community is they're like, we're training to resist the government, but we require absolutely everyone follow every government regulation. It's somewhat silly. But there are license-free options for those who don't want to get a ham license that will enable you to learn the same skills no matter what the hams tell you. But there was a story yesterday out of Idaho where an Amron radio operator, I'm sure you know what that is.
Yes, sir.
The American Readout Radio Operators Network.
Remember myself,
yeah,
yep.
James S. So
or John Jacob Schmidt, Radio Free Readout.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. They saved some lives. There was a car accident, a rollover, and a couple of girls were thrown from the vehicle and had pretty severe injuries. But there was no phone. There was nothing else, no way to get out there. So this person pulled out the radio, tuned it to 14642, and, you know, called out for some Amron help. And the Amron operator was able to hear them, called 911 for them, and coordinate a response. The weather was turning bad, though, even though it didn't look like it. There was a flash storm coming. So he was able to get back on the radio and say, hey, listen, I know you're dealing with a lot, but you need to get these girls covered. You need to find some tarps. There's a rainstorm coming, so they can't get to a helicopter. I guess another Amron person heard this and was nearby, and he ran out with a tourniquet to treat the injuries. There's a great story. I shared it on my Twitter feed. You need to not only get a radio and learn how to use it, but you need to literally carry it with you everywhere you go. And when there's an emergency like that and it's life-threatening, it doesn't matter if you have a license or not. You may broadcast on any channel to get help.
Exactly. No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I heard that story, and you definitely need to have prepared wherever you're going, whether it's a vehicle bag. We talk about that on the Project 223, having the equipment in your rig and knowing how to use it. We practice with yep. some of my friends. We have a radio practice, and like you were saying, you don't necessarily need to get your ham license. The GMRS is a great way to get on radio, being able to use repeaters. And yep. No tests required. You pay the fee, get your FCC license, and it covers your whole family. And I'm sure you're aware of that. But
your whole family, yep. And I keep a GMRS repeater in the trunk of my car.
Yes, sir. Yep. I got one of those too. I'm looking at it right now. So yeah, no, there's lots of great options out there. But like I said, if you don't practice, and we'll talk a little bit more about being a part of a group, and because mutual assistance groups or community groups or whatever you want to call them, they're a great way to practice those things. We're going to hit on that in a little bit. So,
yep.
Great. So that's book one. There's a lot there. You got to get it and read it. It's good information.
You know what, though, you have a good question here that you sent me on book one, and I want to address it.
Yes, sir.
Is it enough to just fill my basement with gear? You know, that's actually a really bad idea, because if you fill your basement with gear and you're like, I'm good. First of all, like we just talked about, you don't know how to use it. You can't pull your radio out of a box that day and think you're going to use it to communicate with someone. You got to be training and using it. The other thing too is that if I fill my basement with gear, I'm now tied to that location. And when the bad guys show up and they try to get in and you fight them off the first time, and then they set your house on fire, you just lost everything you have. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and we'll hit on that a little bit more as we go on. But location is important, and I know someone who's a very prepared guy. But his home and his family are in a suburban subdivision neighborhood, and his gear is there. And so he actually had told me, "Hey, can I make a cache at your place? So because I'm not going to be able to carry everything I have to when I need to leave and get there." So okay, book one. That's book one. Book two is the field craft. So when it comes to field craft, do modern people possess these skills? And what do you mean when you say field craft? Some people might not even know what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. So field craft are those skills to live and move in a hostile environment. So hunters probably have them, right? They know how to move quietly in the woods and not be seen, and how to have a small footprint camp and how to do all this. But no, they don't. And there was a guy who was on the internet for a while. He's still out there, but he got shut down on all the social media platforms. His name was Ivan Throne, and he talked a lot about a dark world. He said, think about your average college graduate right now. They get into some sort of a tech job, most likely. What sort of skills does that man possess if the lights went out tomorrow? And the answer is not a whole lot that are practical for anything, right?
Yep.
So fire building skills, the ability to move and not be seen, the ability to move quietly. And more importantly, what I talk about in book two, there's a lot of stuff on secure camping. So when we think of camping, we envision giant tents, a roaring campfire, songs, everyone having a big cookout. But in a without rule of law situation, that will get you dead, right? So we want to talk about small footprint camping, where it's just me and my very small tent, and it's in earth tones, so it blends in rather than the bright colors tents are made of now. And that's really a hard thing to find, is tents that aren't made that way. They're made to be bright so they can be found if you're lost in the woods. But you might not want to be found. And that's kind of what the whole concept of the Fieldcraft book is about. How to protect yourself from ever getting in a fight by having the skills to avoid it.
Wow, I like that. You know, it's funny when you talk about these things, people say, oh, what's the chance of something like that happening? And I think about often, and we talk about it in Project 223, is, do you have a fire extinguisher in your house? You know,
yeah.
Well, how many fires have you had? How many house fires have you had? Oh, I've never had one. Do you think you're going to have one? Well, I hope not. But you have a fire extinguisher. How about a spare tire in your car? you know, most people, you know, maybe once in their life, but a lot of people never had a flat tire, but yet they carry a spare tire or life insurance, right? I'm hoping I don't never have to use my life insurance. I've never had to use it yet, right? But I've been paying it. I've been paying it for 20 some odd years while I've been raising my kids. But we don't realize it, but we prep in certain areas that are seem socially acceptable, but then we think these other areas might not be. And I can tell you what, to be on the run and being chased and with your family and trying to protect them and not having these skills would be a lot worse than having a fire in your house where you lost.
Here's the thing too. This is even worse because when people do form groups and these groups get out and start training together, they like to do the cool guy stuff, which is shooting targets or talking about these grandiose plans they have. Nobody wants to get down on the ground and low crawl for 200 meters. I guarantee you, if you want some fitness work, low crawl for 200 meters and tell me how your sides, the oblique muscles feel and how your lower legs feel, right? It's great exercise. And it's actually very important skills that no one trains on, even when they think they're prepared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our group, we have what we call the stress course, and we do some target shooting, but then we add in a run up a hill, push-ups, dodging behind barriers up and down from prone to standing, and it puts a whole nother light on how you can perform.
I'll tell you, we used to do a weekend here with these karate schools that I was affiliated with, and we called it the tactical weekend. People would come up, and you had to be 15 or up, and the weekend began with an obstacle course. You're like, hey, you don't get to take your paintball gun with you, but we have paintball guns. And if you violate any of the rules, we just toss you. You know, stay low, you know, stay behind cover, do all this stuff. We're going to pop you somewhere painful with a paintball gun. And it was people had a great time learning how to crawl under barbed wire or go over a wall or do a 3 second, 3 to 5 second rush. These are all skills that you might need. And what a lot of people said when I first wrote it was, yeah, but I went to Army boot camp or Air Force boot camp. Well, guess what? You don't all do it the same. So what I did in Fieldcraft is I took all the U.S. services, the Canadians, Australians, the British, and the Rhodesians when they were still around, and I blended them all together. So even if you went to Army boot camp, there are techniques in there that only the British teach or only the Canadians teach. And you know what? Everyone can learn something from that book.
So continuing on with book two, Fieldcraft, tell me a little bit about the gray man concept, Joe.
So gray man is one of these big misconceptions everyone has, right? So everyone believes that, well, when there's a without rule of law situation or a collapse, I'm going to be the gray man. Well, guess what? When there's a full-on collapse, you can't be the gray man because anyone out and about moving is going to be a target. If you're out and moving, that means that you're at least somewhat healthy, so you probably have food. So I'm going to follow you and get your food. So gray man is good for current world operations. So when I go to like an Antifa protest, totally gray man. I look at what they're wearing. I wear the same thing. I blend in.
Black hoodie, black mask.
Yeah.
Doc Martens.
Absolutely. and that's gray man and that's good. But once things collapse and drop the gray man. You want to go, something where you're not even seen at all, either operating exclusively at night if you're in a city or wearing camouflage and things like that when you're out in the field. And I know you got a note here, which is fantastic, because people are afraid of looking too tactical. Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. However, right now, that's true. But if I'm in a without rule of law situation and that person's trying to decide if they want to take us on and they see five guys, all in camouflage gear, all moving with long guns and sidearms, they're going to pick literally anyone but us to attack because they're going to think that we know what we're doing or we're a military unit. They're going to want to move on. So I get it. A lot of guys want to do the gray man thing. It has its place. If I was going to go into a town and without rule of law situation to gather information, I might go with one or two people in a gray man concept. But they're going to be backed up by a bunch of guys fully geared up and ready to extricate them from trouble. A lot of people are going to cause themselves problems by thinking they can rely on the gray man concept. And how great can you be once the collapse actually comes on? Because you're going to want to be carrying a long gun. And you're going to want to be carrying a handgun. And at that point, gray man's out the window anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. I know a lot of guys that are like, that just don't want to have any camo gear. But that's, you know, I mean, that's just kind of, I think that's still normalcy bias, right? When we see somebody in camo gear right now, they, people either say, oh, they're a wannabe militia or they're a LARPer, but there's a reason why the military wears camo in the field, and it's so that they can stay hidden and know who's on their team and not get taken out, right?
Absolutely. And you know what? There's a lot of research that's gone into that stuff, so you might as well take advantage of your tax dollars. Here's the thing about most camouflage or military type clothing is it's already got insect repellent in it. So there's a benefit. It's also pretty rugged. It's got IR dampeners in it so that, you know, it lowers your infrared reflectiveness. There's all kinds of great benefits to military camouflage patterns. I don't see why in a full-on collapse I wouldn't take advantage of it.
I bet a lot of people have never even had no idea that there was that technology built into that gear.
Absolutely. You know, what's funny is sometimes there was a show that I did on the night of the election, and I was wearing a British camouflage shirt because I was like, hey, since we're setting aside our democracy, I might as well go with British uniform. But the camera, because the way that your laptop camera works, it was making parts of me disappear because of that IR reflective quality, right? So they're like, your shirt is like changing and moving. I'm like, well, yeah, that's what I talk about in my book.
It's technology.
Got AR dancing
lights.
Yeah, and it's kind of cool. But here's the thing. If you're not going to go with full-on camouflage gear, at least buy some high-quality, sturdy outdoor clothing in earth tones so you can blend in a little bit better. And I know a lot of guys want to be the tough guy and say, well, I'm going to take on everybody. But not fighting is better than fighting. And if I can blend in and not be seen, that's 1,000 times better for everyone.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. Yeah. And then just, you know, that survival, being able to survive during that time. I mean, I was thinking about, as I was reading through there and thinking about it, if you're familiar with the 299 Days book series by Glenn Tate, but I've been a fan of that series, and it really helped open my eyes to a lot of potential problems that can happen during a collapse. But there was a storyline about a guy who lived in Bellevue and kind of a yuppie there and very, very unprepared, and his wife. And when the collapse came and the family was suffering and they couldn't get out of the town, the wife looked at him and was like, honey, why didn't, you know, he didn't have a gun to even survive, help his family protect them. And she said, why didn't you get a gun? And he said, well, dear, you told me you didn't want me to get one. She goes, well, you should have been a man and done what you knew you should have done. And I just,
you know what? This is true, right?
I thought of that, right? It's like we may think that, well, camouflage clothing and this gear, you know, I don't know. But when the time comes, if I need that fire extinguisher, I better have a good fire extinguisher that's got enough powder or water in it to put out the fire, and it better be in date, and I better know how to use it, right? And the same with gear.
Yeah, you know, and I'll use another example that works great from American history. The men who lived on the pioneer or on the frontier, they were the ultimate militant farmers, right? So he was a farmer, and every day he was out in his yard working in his farm clothes. But when somebody came up and said, hey, listen, the Dutch or the French just raided, you know, John's farm down the road, that guy went in his house and he threw on his deerskin clothes that matched the environment, right? Grabbed his rifle, grabbed his pack, moved his family to wherever they were all going to fort up, which we talk about in book three. He moved his family in with the other families, and then the men went out and did what needed to be done, came home and changed his clothes. It's a classic example that we could all follow.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, and I think also too in book two, I think near the end you have a character study of David, and we got into that a little bit earlier, but I really like that he was a true warrior.
You know, everyone wants to talk about the parts of David where he was weeping and crying and sad because of all the bad things he did. But first of all, just because he was imperfect, although he was still God's vision of a perfect king, even though he messed up. That's all of us. We all mess up every single day. But the other piece of it is that when you actually get in and you actually study David and the things he did and the things he went through, David ran his own private military company. He was running contracts along the border, protecting
right.
convoys going back and forth. I mean, he was a legit warrior, and he took care of his families. And there's a story in my book about that, they were doing some work for some other group, and when their families were in danger, they dropped what they were doing and they ran off, chased down the bad guys, and eliminated them. And that's kind of the type of person we need to be. And a piece of good news we'll share here on this podcast, I haven't told other podcasts, is once I get past book six, right, which should probably be sometime in the spring, book six will be the field skills handbook where we talk about making fire and building things with rope and wood and all that kind of stuff. Once I get past that, I'll have done six warrior studies of different characters from the Bible. And what we're going to do is we're going to actually write a 10 to 12 week Bible study where we just discuss biblical warriors and what lessons we can learn from them. So it's going to be kind of cool.
Wow. That'll be good. Now, how will we be able to get that? Will that be available on the website, or?
It's probably going to be on my website. Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited for that. I want to be one of the first, So I'm going to be watching anxiously on that one. So.
Right on. Right on.
Did we, book six is Field Skills. Is the book five's title public yet, or?
First aid.
Okay.
And it's not going to be, right now when everyone talks about first aid, they want to talk about gunshot wounds. But answer me this question. How often have you fallen down versus how many gunfights have you been in?
Exactly.
I'm betting you've fallen down a lot more times, right? And in a without rule of law situation with no medical services forthcoming, a sprained ankle can be fatal. A broken arm can kill you. A broken jaw will kill you because you can't eat. So how do we treat these things? How do we reduce them in an austere environment where there might not be help coming? And a lot of guys will say, well, I got the U.S. Army field manual on first aid, so I'm good. But that manual is built upon the concept known as the golden hour, which means you're only treating them for that first hour. And after that, they're going to be in the hands of a medical professional. That's not going to be our case, right? We're going to need a little bit more advanced medical skills and maybe some of the old school treatments we used to use for things that will work. So it's going to be a pretty interesting first aid book for number five.
And I'm thinking, Joe, is there any examples you can think of where somebody pulled out their first aid kit and helped somebody injured along the road?
Jeez, man, in my life, that has happened about 15 times.
Well, I'm thinking from the Bible. You tell the story about the good Samaritan.
In book one, the Good Samaritan story is the basis for the entire first aid chapter.
I love it, yeah.
He went to him and bandaged his wounds and put oil on him. Listen, that is God's command to treat wounded people when you find them. It's pretty awesome.
Oh, I'm looking forward to book five in the first aid section. Yeah, I know I teach that during the Project 223. We talk about the IFAC, but we also talk about the boo-boo kit and then your comprehensive medical kit. So I'm looking at my AMP3 clinic in a roll. That's a great company if anybody is familiar with them. But
there you go.
But there's a lot more to first aid than just that IFAC kit. So and I also think too, and we're going to talk about a little bit in a minute, but about in part of your community group or your mutual assistance group in your network, how important is it to have a paramedic or an EMT or a doctor, even a dentist?
It's absolutely required. And you know what? Another person that can be drafted in a pinch is a veterinarian. But I also challenge people too, that if you have pets, you need to take a pet first aid class and a pet CPR class.
Huh.
So, yeah.
I never thought of that. Well, because you think about what a great resource. Like I have an R pooch, in the middle of the night last night, he started making noise and I'm like, what's going on? I looked outside. Well, sure enough, my son was out there and he was out in the yard and hanging out. So somebody was out there and he knew it. And so to have that resource of having a dog there that can help you and your family out. But you got to be able to take care of them too.
I've got a pair of Australian shepherds that are a security resource. They have jobs, so they need to be taken care of just as well as everyone else.
That's great. It reminds me of I don't know if you've seen that show, The Old Man, there with Jeff Bridges recently on.
I have not.
It's pretty interesting. Check that out. So yeah, you'll see. So great. So that's book two. Anything else you want to share about that before we move on to book three?
I think that book two contains some serious hard skills that everyone needs to learn and practice often. So.
Okay. Serious hard skills. I agree with you on that. I really enjoyed it. Okay. Well, I think we're going to stop there and call that the end of the Joe Dolio interview part one. We've gotten so far all the way up to book number three. So if you come and join us next time, we'll start there and finish off the remainder of the books in Joe's Tactical Wisdom series. So from the Eagle's Nest, This is Brent, the Bald Eagle, signing off. We're learning a lot of good information, and I can't wait to finish up this interview on the next episode. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, and have a great day.